As we approach the 60th anniversary of Moore's Law, you can look it up if you've not heard of it, you might be forgiven for thinking we've squeezed as much juice out of that lemon as we can. And you're not the only one. Engineers and businesses that rely on finding a performance edge over their competitors are fretting that the days of the huge performance gains that Gordon Moore predicted are over. But today's guest thinks differently. They believe that the problem is one of being locked into old ways of thinking about how to design a computer. They're tearing up the rulebook with something they call memory-centric infrastructure. Before we get into that topic, though, let's take a moment to thank Rocket Software for making today's episode possible. If you haven't already, please check them out at rocketsoftware.com to see why over 10 million IT professionals rely on them every day to run their most critical business applications, processes, and data. Welcome to another episode of Digital Disrupted with me, your host, Paul Muller. Well, today's guest has built an impressive track record launching new businesses, some of which were later acquired by some of Silicon Valley's best known names. Today, we're talking about his latest, most disruptive business. Welcome CEO and co-founder of Memverge, Charles Fan. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Thank you for having me here.
It's great to have you. Where do we find you today? Where are you coming from?
I'm in California, Milpitas, California.
A lovely part of the world, and hopefully fall is treating you nicely. Is the weather cold there at the moment?
It is getting a little chilly, probably in the 60s.
I think that's the biggest mistake everybody makes when they think about moving to Silicon Valley. They just assume it's always warm. The winters can get quite chilly. All right. Well, before we jump into the topic of talking about this new way of thinking about computing and really taking advantage of all of this incredible random access memory that's available, we have a little thing that we call the lightning round. Are you ready to play the game, Charles?
Sure, if I have to.
It's a condition of entry. I'm sure there's a contract someone signed somewhere. Okay. Hey, listen, no, seriously, let's have a bit of fun with this. First question I ask every guest that joins us is, what would people say is your superpower?
I would say it's, I think with Wolverine, and it's the self-healing ability where you get stabbed and the wound heal itself. I've been doing startups as founders, and I think that's a required ability because you get stabbed every day. and you can get knocked down, but never get knocked out. You have to get back up and keep running.
That's fabulous. I thought for a second there you were going to tell me you actually have that superpower. I'm like, that's incredible. But no, that resiliency is so important, as you say, because it's not easy. And I'd love to ask you a few more questions about what you've learned as a founder later on. Next question, the most disruptive technology of all time.
Well, it's a very good question, a very difficult one for a technologist to answer because there's so many. But I think I was discussing this with my wife the other day. And I like her answer better than all my answers. And that's a flush toilet. and I think that's a technology kind of using nature and really make a difference to our daily lives.
It really, really does. Thank goodness somebody invented that. I can only imagine the opposite of that. I love it. That's a great answer. What was your answer going to be? I'm curious.
Well, I had too many answers. I couldn't figure out, you know.
We should point out to our listeners that you've got a PhD in engineering. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. Degree. So I think too much.
you're an expert in disruptive technology. All right, the best quality a leader can have.
I am a believer in authenticity. I think there's always a trap for a leader to pretend what he or she is not. And I think it's important for a leader to stay out of that trap and to be himself or herself.
And on that note, your advice to people starting their careers?
So if I was starting my career, and in fact, what I think I benefit most was, you know, to have a good mentor or have some person I work with that I learn a lot from. So to extend from that, I think the most important thing for a young person starting his career is that he needs to be lucky enough to be around the smartest people, the kindest people, the people who can really show him or her what's possible and what's the right way. So I think working with the best people would be my advice to a young person starting their career.
Yeah, and it's really important, I think. Gene Kim, a friend of the show, a friend of mine, says something to the effect of, you know, you're only as smart as the smartest people you hang around, so hang around smarter people, or, you know, authentic people, or really for young people to seek out the qualities that they want to see in themselves. The company you keep is really important. I agree. Yeah. All right. The first phrase or first words that come to mind when you think about memory.
So we'll be talking a lot about memory today, but interestingly, I think the first word I would say is Coco. And for those of you who have seen the movie Coco, it's an animation from Disney. And this is it's a great movie, by the way. It's not only for kids, but I think for adults as well. And this is concept where a person dies, but he or she never really dies until everybody forget about him or her. So really you live in the memory of others. And the whole movie is about how you know they try to keep the memory of some person alive. And there's some, I think, deep truth to it, is that memory is a form of consciousness. And in some way that's how the world exists, and kind of the fundamental form of the world exists in this consciousness, in this memory. And then if we apply them to technology per se, then memory is the essence of information, the essence of information technology. So that happens to be an area that we are working on today.
What a profound way to start the show. All right, last question in the lightning round. If you could use technology to solve one world problem, what would it be and why?
Well, there are so many problems in the world right now. And I'm not sure if technology is helping solving it or contributing to them. You know, I think I'll have a very boring answer in a way that I hope technology can help in bring about world peace. and it is because I think, you know, with nowadays, we have been in a very dangerous period. I think there are a lot of risks around, both internationally and within a country as well. There are so many conflicts, so many different opinions that can clash violently. And, you know, it may not be directly what I'm working on, but I hope technology can help improve the situation rather than worsen the situation, you know, really helping more communication and sympathy between different people of different opinions, rather than worsen it and creating echo chambers and escalate a conflict in the wrong direction.
Well, if peace is boring, I really hope to have a boring day.
Because,
we could definitely use more of that. That's right. A great answer. Thank you so much. All right, well, let's talk a bit about your work and what you're doing at MemVerge and some of the breakthroughs that you're pushing for. Because a lot of this is about a breakthrough. One of the things I thought was interesting in looking into the company is you don't see this as a short-term tech trend or fad. You really do see this as a sort of 10 or 20 year journey of really rethinking some of the basics of the von Neumann architecture. But before we jump into that, maybe just worth sharing a little bit about your background, because you're, despite being a PhD in engineering, you're actually also a serial entrepreneur. So you've mixed business and tech together into a brilliant combination. How did you get to be where you are?
I started my career starting a company, actually. I was still a grad student at Caltech, and my professor, my advisor, asked me if I want to join him in a startup, which I said yes. And that's related to one of my earlier answers. I think he has been a great mentor to me about 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago. And in fact, he is my co-founder now in the startup today. So he's really been part of my life, and we have been a great partner together. So that's how I started a career, is being a co-founder of a company with my professor and a couple other friends, my you know, classmates. And that company was doing system level software. And my PhD was in distributed computing in an electrical engineering department. And we were designing distributed software to have computers to work with each other. We applied that to security area, and then we applied that to the storage area. So really, starting with my first startup, I was doing software, storage software. And that company called Ringfinity, which was eventually acquired by EMC, which is a storage company. And I worked there for a few years and then moved to VMware, which is a virtualization software company. And my team created a product called vSAN, a leader in software-defined storage that became a $1 billion product. And that was a great success. My team did as part of VMware. And then about 5 years ago that I came to the realization, the next big thing, you know, coming from storage, we think that what's next, what was the next big thing in storage is memory. That as a modern application drives the demand of data, both in velocity and in volume, bigger and faster at the same time, the existing storage architecture is no longer adequate to meet that challenge. So the answer lies in creating bigger memory to answer to that challenge. So that's how we started this company, Memverge, 5 years ago.
It's quite a journey. Before we jump into the topic of Memverge, I'm just curious, you've succeeded in innovating and creating a startup both outside of a company, which is, you know, I think of as being intrinsically hard because, you know, you are doing it often with your own time and your own capital, your own sweat equity, at least to a certain point. You've got a lot of credibility. You've got to build market presence, awareness, et cetera. You've also built a startup within a large established name. How would you characterize the difference between the two? Because I know a lot of our audience members are probably sitting in one of the other and thinking, gee, I wish I was in the opposite of my current situation because life would be easier. Does the question make sense?
Yeah, it does. I sometimes think about it myself. I think whether it is large company or small company, both are challenging. They all have their set of challenges. Both can be a platform or a stage where you can realize great successes. With small companies, you have less resources. You also have less meetings to go to. So you can really focus on the task at hand. And given the constraint on the resources, be as agile, as flexible as you can. You have less things to lose and more things to gain. So it's a lot of fun if you're working with a great group of people and working on a very interesting problem. And at the end of the day, you can help customers solving their pain with a new innovation. There is very few feelings in the world that can compare to that. Now, with a larger company, that you have a bigger platform, you have more resources, there are quite a number of things that you can only do in a large company. Like, it's very difficult for small companies to compete with larger companies. If you're solving an existing problem, creating an incrementally better solution, it will be very difficult for a small company to challenge a big company. And that's where you can be successful in a larger company. Now, creating a new venture inside a larger company is especially difficult. And you're right about that. And I think, thankfully for me, it was really the team did some fantastic work there. And the company has a leadership that has the toughness to protect a new initiative. It's often a new initiative can be sort of killed by the other larger initiatives, not out of ill will, just naturally. And the small initiative, the initial revenue really doesn't move the dial. You really have to have the vision to protect those, for them to survive the most vulnerable first few years. And I think that's what happened at VMware, how vSAN was protected by really the effort together from the leadership all the way to the fantastic engineering team who are developing it. And we were lucky to see that through to some good successes.
Yeah, I really appreciate those insights. And what I'm hearing is there really is no magic formula for innovation. If you think that, you know, if you're in a small startup thinking, gosh, if only I was acquired by one of the giants, life would be easier. You know, it's still hard. And if you're in one of the giants thinking, I just need to leave and start a new company, get rid of all this bureaucracy, don't forget there's a whole wall of money behind you and a lot of established brand and traction and simple things like a 24/7 international call center, right? There's all of these things that are sort of hidden benefits of being part of a large organization that you don't really notice till it's gone. Really appreciate that insight. I think it's great to get the experience from someone else. Let's talk a bit about your current work. Maybe you could start by helping clarify something. I've looked at some of the work that you've been doing, and I hear terms like big memory. What is big memory, and how did you come to define the term?
This is probably an oversimplification of a name, but I think it captures the sort of, if you look at from 30,000 feet, that captures the essence of what we do. When you look at data together, there are like two baskets where you put the data. inside of a computer of any kind, from iPhone to a, you know, big server that's in a data center. Those two baskets are either memory or storage. And memory typically are DRAM, and that's sitting within the computer. And storage are either, you know, flash SSDs or hard drives or even tape that could be sitting inside a computer or outside a computer in a special device. And the reason there are two baskets today is because they are very different. Memory is very fast. It's about 1,000 times faster than storage, but it is small. You know, it's orders of magnitude smaller than storage, and it's more expensive, also orders of magnitude more expensive than storage. And it's typically volatile, meaning if you lose the power, you lose the data in your memory. Now, storage is slower, but it has, you know, where memory is not so good, storage very good at. It's kind of cheap and deep, and you can have a lot of storage, but not a lot of money, but it's a little slower. And it's persistent, meaning you don't need power. If you put some data there, it's going to stay there. So because there are these two things, you need them both today. And you put sort of the data that's the most needed into memory and all the other data in storage. And if your memory is not big enough, the data overflows to storage. And this really leads to two fundamental bottlenecks that existing computing systems are seeing. The first one can be referred to as a memory wall. The other one can be referred to as I/O wall. So the memory wall is the bottleneck of the data transfer between compute and memory. In other words, another word for it is memory bandwidth. So with modern applications like AI and so on, it requires more and more data to be processed faster and faster. So you need to move more and more data into computing units, CPUs or GPUs and so on. And then memory bandwidth can become the bottleneck. The second bottleneck is I/O wall, is one when the memory is not big enough, you need to go to storage to access your data. And storage access is much slower. So the storage access is typically referred to as I/O, input output. And there's storage I/O, there's networking I/O if storage is somewhere else outside of the computer. So the storage I/O and networking I/O are often the bottleneck of today's data-centric applications. So there are these two bottlenecks that are very fundamental in today's data centers. And the purpose of big memory is to create a memory that's big in two ways. One, it's bigger in capacity so that more data can be placed in memory without going to storage. Therefore, eliminate the needs of incurring I/Os. And this can solve the I/O wall problem. If you can put all or at least most of your data in your memory, have architecture that can allow that to happen, then you avoid the I/Os. So that solves the I/O problem. The second is you want to make the memory bandwidth to be bigger. So that can alleviate the memory wall problem, that can increase the amount of data transfers between compute and memory. So that's what big memory intends to solve, is to increase the memory bandwidth and increase the memory capacity. Therefore, it provides a better solution to overcome those two fundamental bottlenecks.
I will have to ask the question about volatility, though, because you talked about volatility. How does big memory address that question? Because that is obviously the issue with random access memory, or RAM as it's called.
Right. So today the DRAM is volatile, and there has been research and development on new persistent kind of memory. Now, what's existing today are NAND flash, which is kind of a memory device, but it's mostly used in storage because it's not quite fast enough to be used in memory yet. And that is a persistent memory media. And Intel introduced a product called Optane, persistent memory, that is a faster persistent media that can improve the situation. And we actually have been working with Intel pretty closely in promoting the usage of Optane memory. Now Intel did announce the winding down of the Optane business 3 months ago. So it's a little bit of a setback on the persistent memory technology, but it's not the end of story for that. I think there are other technologies that we are aware of being developed across a few other industry leaders that we might see them in the coming years. And so in terms of persistence, our big memory are looking at two ways. The first is to incorporate NAND flash into our architecture so that we can provide some persistent features into our entire solution. The second is that when there are actual new persistent media come to existence, I think they're going to match really well with a big memory architecture.
Excellent. And we should probably explain what the term persistence means for people who are wondering what we're talking about when we use the words volatility and persistence.
So persistence equals to non-volatile. So it's the opposite to volatile. And simply, if you turn off the machine, whether the data stays there or not. If it stays there, it's persistent. If it does not, it's volatile.
Excellent. Thank you for clarifying. So, and I can see why your Wolverine powers are important, as you mentioned, that some of the changes with for example, Optane, and then working with new partners coming up. Let's talk a little bit about I talked about this at the opening when we talked about Moore's Law. Is a lot of people focus on the performance of compute around the CPU and, you know, scaling architectures based around more CPUs.
Yeah.
But if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is, while, you know, Moore's Law, obviously we're starting to hit the boundaries of physics here as transistors reach the point where they're, you know, bordering on a couple of atoms wide. With what I'm hearing from you is there's still so many areas for optimization. I know it's not a direct compare to what you're talking about with Memverge, but I remember upgrading from my hard drive to a flash drive in my computer, and the computer was still the same computer, but it felt like it had been brought forward 10 years.
Yeah.
It was, I got more bang for buck out of that same CPU architecture. Is that really the simplistic value proposition for big memory, that I'll be able to take some of the existing CPU architectures that we have today and by smarter I/O get more compute compute power out of those devices? Or when I say devices, I mean servers, obviously we're not talking about smartphones. Yeah.
It is. So we all are aware of the physical limitation that we are getting close to. But computing power per core is not the only variable that drives the overall computing performance or data center performance. There are other variables that can improve the overall performance. And in general, I think you can looking at the performance of each critical component and the interactions between these components. And I think each of these would be a point of optimization. To start on the computing itself, certainly we are hitting the Moore's Law limit, or Moore's Law might no longer be valid. However, there are new architectures that are driving more and more cores. And there are smart people working on those things to increase in computing power. A common element is that number of cores is going to increase dramatically and become more heterogeneous. So that's the reason why heterogeneous computing is a very lively topic that we are talking about right now. And then the other key elements, including memory, how can you make memory element to be more performant, and storage? How can you make storage component more performant, and could possibly networking? So there, each of these are pillars of a data center that can become the bottleneck of the data center. And then you're looking at the interaction between each of them, whether it's the data movement between those elements, such as the memory wall and I/O wall I discussed. And then there is another concept which is relevant here, that is a disaggregation or decoupling between these components. Storage and networking have been largely decoupled from compute, meaning I can add more cores without impacting my storage or networking. And I can increase storage without impacting my cores. They can be scaled and managed independently to each other. What's left behind, the laggard in the disaggregation, is memory. Like, memory today is still pretty tightly coupled to compute. So you couldn't freely scale one without the other. The memory today, sitting server boxes, that I couldn't just say, like, let me double my memory without changing my core. And sometimes you just don't have enough DIMM slots, enough capacity within that server to allow you to scale your memory. So this disaggregation really gives the flexibility for you to optimize the performance of your data center. And coming back to the topic of big memory, how it is related to this is that we essentially achieve a couple of different things. One is we can increase the bandwidth between different elements, therefore improving the overall performance. The other, maybe equally important, is a new standard that's emerging today called CXL. It's called Compute Express Link. It is a new interconnect, kind of a new memory bus that you can connect all kinds of compute and all kinds of memory to it. So this is a flexible interface sitting on top of PCIe Gen 5 or later, and you can attach heterogeneous computing elements and heterogeneous memory elements. And what's more, because it's sitting on PCIe, this can sitting both inside of the server box as well as outside the server box. You could have a PCIe switch or CXL switch that can connect any amount of memory to any amount of servers. And there could be different kind of processors in these servers, and any of these processors can access any of the memory as you need it. And you can scale processors independent of memory, and you can scale memory independent of processors that give you the flexibility to configure the computing units that's optimal for your workload, for your applications. And this is a new architecture of big memory that we are trying to create. It is based on this CXL interconnect, allow compute and memory to be disaggregated, and each can scale freely independent of the other.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because it was one of the things going through my mind listening to you is, you know, that's great, Charles. So, you know, we remove the bottleneck of, you know, spinning magnetic media. We move to NAND flash. It's faster again, several orders of magnitude. Then we move to memory based, which is an order or two, what, 1,000 times faster again than NAND flash. It's really fast. But we've not done anything about the I/O. So what was going through my mind is, if we're just going to plug this incredible new architecture straight into our existing I/O channels, we're not going to see much, if any, benefit from it. So this is actually a left-right punch, by the sounds of things. You've got the you've got this incredible new capability, but you're building a new interconnect to help people access it. And I love the idea that you're going to be able to share that amongst multiple CPUs. So I guess the question, and excuse me to the audience if we're getting really nerdy here, but this, as you know, I sometimes do this. Am I going to have to, if I'm a business person, am I going to need to rewrite my software to take advantage of all these new architectures?
Yeah, that's where our software comes in. The short answer is no, especially if you have software such as Memverges that can virtualize this complexity away from you so that your existing application can work as is. And I think this marks the timing history that for the first time, software becomes important for memory. Software has been important for many things, but not for memory. Memory is today entirely a hardware business. But because of this new architecture, the complexity it brings, in order for the applications and users to use it appropriately, software became important. And this is analogous to how storage software became important in the 1990s. You know, way back to the 1980s, there's not really an independent storage software business. But in 1990, once you have fiber channel, you have storage area network, you get the complexity architecture that brings a whole bunch of benefits. That's when storage software industry was born. And they grew into an industry of tens of billions of dollars. And we think today is the same point in history, the same thing going to happen to memory.
It's just incredible stuff. Why do you think, just based on reading again some background on you, why do you think this is going to be such a big thing for modernizing the cloud?
I think cloud is all about fungible resources, composable, fungible resources, and memory hasn't been so fungible until now, or until maybe the next 5 years. And I think CXL and this big memory architecture will redefine the cloud infrastructure so that making memory of a more fungible, scalable resource, independent to compute, independent storage. And also we believe the larger memory will enable new applications to perform at a much higher level as well. And then there are various data services. As memory become bigger, it needs more data services. Just like when storage became bigger 30 years ago, it needs a whole bunch of data services. Same thing going to happen here. And these data services going to live across the hybrid cloud, you know, in public cloud as well as in private data centers.
It's just incredible stuff. What do you see as being some of the inhibitors to adoption? Obviously, the first, at least as I see it, is wrapping your brain around this very, in some respects, radical concept of thinking about memory in the same way, as you say, you think about virtualized storage or virtualized networking, a complete decoupling of the physical from the logical. What are some of the other inhibitors that you're sort of anticipating or seeing as you're taking this concept out to the world?
I think it's a very compelling proposition, but it does take time. It requires a ecosystem to be established from the hardware leaders who are creating the devices and creating the system, to the software guys like ourselves, to the actual users who would really be the adopter of these concepts. So I think this takes time. It takes an education of the market. But I think the value proposition is so compelling that I'm very optimistic over the next 5 years that we're going to see a broad adoption of this new architecture.
Yeah, look, I've got to say, I'm extremely excited by what you're talking about. And I'm also kicking myself because I'm sitting there thinking, we've had virtual memory since we go back to the old IBM mainframe with VM, right? I think it was probably the first system that popularized it. So that must be at least 50 years. But you've just taken the notion of virtual memory to a completely, to its logical conclusion. But as you pointed out, you've also coupled it to the physical infrastructure, which is probably the big difference.
It is. And I think many of the concepts are not new, but just with the new hardware advances, a new speed increases. Now this becomes possible.
But also the software. I mean, you've done some amazing things, as you say, with the software around it. Just incredible stuff. At the risk of getting super nerdy, and we spoke about this a little bit before the show, you know, if I was to... I've got two questions before I do that. The first one was, as I was reading and doing some background work, I came across the term memory-centric infrastructure. How is that different from big memory, if at all?
Not really different. I think these are just the different names we have given to the architecture that we are designing. We initially called memory-centric infrastructure, you know, recognizing memory going to become more central in a data center. Then later on, we were told it's a little too geeky a name. So I think then we kind of having a new name, but really the same thing, calling it big memory, which is a simpler term, but it's also pretty descriptive. But they are really talking about the same thing, this new architecture where memory become more central and it's going to become bigger, it's going to become faster, it's going to become disaggregated, it can be shareable between different CPUs, and overall it's going to drive a transformation of a data center.
I can imagine there's probably a few people listening thinking, you know, I've heard of SAP HANA, which was large memory-based system for processing data in things like data warehouses. Talked about many of the same intrinsic concepts, but it sounds to me like we're talking about a fundamentally different architectural approach to HANA. Can you elaborate on that?
I think the application trend of moving to bigger and bigger memory started 15 years ago. You know, not only HANA, which is a in-memory database, is there. There are other in-memory databases, data grids that came into existence over the last 15 years in big data and AI applications. They can never have enough memory. So they would use up however much memory you give to it and more. So they are very memory hungry applications, and most of the modern data centric applications act in such a way. I think what we are doing is to really bridging the gap between what's available into the infrastructure to this new application design that has already taken place. And our goal is, through this transformation, a better memory-centric infrastructure, you know, MCI, as you mentioned, ocean core big memory, became available to answer to the needs of applications such as HANA and others.
Yeah. Just to be clear, I guess the difference, if I understand it at a technical level, is in something like HANA, I'm trying to shove more DRAM, more DIMMs, to get really nerdy. I'm trying to shove more physical memory into the same box. Yep. You're talking about with MCI, because I sort of, it might be geeky, but I like it. You're talking about putting it into a different box, but making it appear to the system as though it's just more RAM. If I got that roughly right?
We are actually talking about both. So I think big memory or MCI, including both increasing the amount of memory per box, as well as creating a pool of devices, a pool of memory that's available to any of the servers that's connecting to it. So it is a combination of local as well as remote shared memory pool. And they are not in conflict with each other. I think it is complementary. To have a remote memory pool is complementary to the maximum memory you can have per system.
Incredible stuff. Look, absolutely brilliant. What, as you look out into your crystal ball, what do you think this means to, you know, not just the technologists listening, but what do you think it means to business people, to the common person on the street?
I think to the common people, to the non-geeky crowd, people like us, for the normal people, I think what it means is the innovation is not stopping in the area of infrastructure, despite, you know, the facts about certain physical limits related to Moore's law. I think you're going to continue to see more performant infrastructure emerging, and that can support the emergence of new innovative applications. So I would say, you know, continue build innovative applications that can process more and more data, and I think the infrastructure will follow, and it might take a couple of revolutions in terms of architecture for that to happen, but that would make people like us happy. And I think that give us a job to create a new architecture to answer to that challenge.
Fabulous stuff. Absolutely fabulous stuff. Where can people go to learn more if they'd like to learn more about either Memverge or Big Memory?
We have a website at www.memverge.com. Come to our website to find more information. You can email us at info@memverge.com. We are actually organizing a series of conferences we call CXL Forum. And there were just a couple that took place last month, and there will be more coming, and the schedule is being published on our website. You are welcome to register. There are online and offline versions of it. They'll learn all about big memory, all about CXL. And we think it's a big game changer. And that's going to really transform the architecture in the next 5 years.
Well, you've convinced me. As we wrap up, the show sponsor, Rocket Software, big shout out to them, have a set of values they like to talk about that matter to them: empathy, humanity, trust, and love. Question for you, Charles, what matters to you right now?
I think trust and love and peace are all good. And and I think, you know, maybe if I use one word, I'm a little bit of a Taoist in nature, and I like the word harmony. And I like to feel man's harmony with the nature, and I like to feel the man's harmony with each other. And I think you can call it love, you can call it other things, empathy and so on. And that's what's important to me, and I think to all of us.
What a fabulous way to wrap up the show. Thank you so much, Charles. And thanks again to Rocket Software for bringing us another episode of Digidisruptor. And thank you all for listening in. If you like what you've heard, I can't stress enough, we'd love you to give us a thumbs up on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you happen to be listening. You can also reach out to me on the Twitter. My Twitter handle's @XTheStreams, or our show sponsor for that matter, @Rocket. So if you've got any questions for our guests like Charles, or ideas for topics you'd like to hear covered on future shows, reach out. We'd love to hear from you. We always reply. With that, we'll see you all next week. We won't see you. This is a podcast. I keep saying that.
Thank you, Paul.
We'll see you all next week. Stay disruptive, everyone.